Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. U.S. Women's National Team, a terrible loss to Sweden in PKs in the round of 16 of the Women's World Cup. And we're going to talk a little bit about how the women's team is kind of looked upon by the general national audience, because I would like to say a lot of people are disappointed, but at the same time, it's a weird... Like, are you supporting them? And then you get mad when they lose, even though you're not supporting them. It's very much reminiscent of the men's national team for basketball in the Olympics. So we got that. NFL Hall of Fame 2023, some of the inductees. Let's take a stroll down memory lane. Alvin Kamara suspended for the first three games. Anthony Davis, massive contract extension. Is that going to pay off for the Lakers or not? Tim Anderson and Jose Ramirez. So Jake Paul, Nate Diaz, not the only big fight that was this weekend. I didn't watch that fight because I have no interest in the Paul brothers. But Tim Anderson and Jose Ramirez, some crazy, crazy fight between the Guardians and the White Sox. And then I'm pretty much checked out on Carlos Rodon already for the Yankees. He's come back and just been flat out horrible. Just stinker after stinker he throws up. But first, a reminder that if you sign up to Underdog Fantasy using promo code Animal House, you will get 100% match deposit up to $100. It is quick, easy. The link is going to be in the description of the podcast. So just scroll down, click that. It's also in my links on Instagram at From My Point of View Pod, and then also Animal House USA on Instagram as well. Links in their description too. So a lot of different ways to get there. Quick, easy, sign up to $100 if you want. You can do 10, 15, 20, whatever it is. So again, Animal House on Underdog Fantasy when you sign up, and you will get 100% match deposit. All right. So the women's national team, the U.S. women's national team lost in the round of 16 in the World Cup this year. It is the earliest exit that they have ever had, dating all the way back to 1991. So they won in the earliest elimination ever. They won in 91. They made the semifinals in 95. They won again in 99. They made the semifinals in back-to-back World Cups in 03 and 07. Then they lost in the finals in 2011. Then they won back-to-back World Cups in 2015 and 2019. And then 2023, they lose in the round of 16. It is certainly disappointing. It is something, though, that is kind of this double-edged thing going on in the country where feel like a lot of people were necessarily watching them or outwardly supporting them, but they're now at the point where they're in such a difficult position because it's win or it's a failure. Like, that's where they're at. So it's very much reminiscent of the men's basketball, USA basketball national team, because everyone, even if you don't watch the games, even if you're not like outwardly supporting this team and its players, there are a lot of people who sit back and say, we demand perfection. You know, we demand that you go out and win, and not only win, but that you dominate, because that's where this women's national team is being held and where, quite frankly, they deserve to be held there. They are an unbelievably talented, exceptional soccer team. And when you stack them up against the rest of the world, we usually come out on top in women's soccer. We are dominant in that regard and have been for the past like decade plus. But when you look at it through that lens of failure, you know, winning or failure, it is exhausting. It's totally exhausting. So unfortunately for America, the World Cup this year was like New Zealand and Australia. So every game started at like 5 a.m. or 4 a.m., stupid early. And I woke up at like 8 o'clock, and 10 minutes prior, just about, the women's national team had been eliminated in PKs by Sweden. So, you know, a lot of people are just waking up and the games are ending. You have to like be able to set your alarm and get up and watch during those wee hours of the morning. And a lot of people aren't going to do that, right? Myself included. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say it's this a complete abject failure and it's, I can't believe the USA lost. They should be embarrassed, yada, yada, yada. I'm not going to sit here and make those opinions because one, I'm not qualified to talk about like the women's national team on that level. I just don't have enough knowledge about it. And two, I never made the effort to like get up and actually watch the games and support the team. So I'm not going to now rag on them just because they lost when I didn't even watch them in the first place. But just from the landscape in media and on social media, with their thoughts about it, I'm able to kind of piece together exactly what's going on. So with the women's national team, it doesn't seem like there was the same draw from America because the games were on so early in the morning. A lot of people couldn't watch them. So that's a big blow, right? Not being able to get, you know, prime time hours on the East and what, even the West Coast and the East Coast, prime time hours for the World Cup for your women's team is tough. It really is tough. So that doesn't help things. And then you have some former players and other people saying the USA just, they look like they're sleepwalking. This happened after, I think they tied Vietnam or they had a couple ties, I believe. And people were saying, you know, this, it doesn't look like they're interested. Like it looks like they're taking it for granted. You know, they're sleepwalking. And the U.S. national team coach said it's hard to, he resented the fact that, you know, some former players or analysts are saying that they're taking it for granted and they're sleepwalking because it's hard. It's hard to get to that level and it's hard to maintain that, you know, that that height of dominance. And they practice hard and they train hard and they do what they have to do. But at the end of the day, it is difficult to win. It's the World Cup, right? A lot of people thought that the USA, though, from what I see on Twitter, which, you know, grain of salt, but they look at it and say the USA, they played sloppy the entire time. They played sloppy the entire time. It looked like there was no fire underneath them at all. And then this is what happens in PKs. And the goal they lose on PKs is a rough one. It is very like, it was a save that deflected off the hands of our goalkeeper and then barely trickled over the line. They had to use the replay system, the VR like replay system to determine that the ball went fully over the white line by like literally a hair, a hair's length, a hair's thickness. It went over that line and it gave Sweden the win, but it should have been a block. I don't know. That seems whack to me. That replay system is BS to me. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But it was a tough way to lose, obviously in PKs, and it was something that a lot of people were disappointed in. But that brings me back to my point of how this team is now basically on the same level as Team USA. So you can equate this, I would guess, if you want to try and make it as simple as possible with a one-to-one comparison. You can make this, like when the USA lost in Athens, I think it was, in 2004, the Olympics. We got like the bronze medal and it was embarrassing. We got bronze and it was embarrassing. So this is the women's team that got eliminated in the round of 16. But with that USA team, you had a bunch of super talented players that just did not play well together, particularly well together. And that was a point in USA basketball where you were bringing in guys that weren't necessarily the best, they were really good. A lot of really good players on that team, but they weren't necessarily the best at the time. So you went from having like the dream team and whatever to now a team where it's like mid-level all-stars instead of like the top tier all-stars in the NBA performing for Team USA. And it ended up with us getting bronze and we were embarrassed. And then that leads to the redeem team and all that kind of stuff. So USA basketball is very much at the point where a lot of people aren't going to watch. They're just not interested. There's this weird thing with America where when we become the best at something, people just kind of like sit back and expect greatness and just expect us to win, but they won't go out of their way to watch or actively support these teams that we put together. So when they lose, they just kind of the average Joe will throw their hands up and say, well, they're a failure. They're a disappointment. They didn't live up to the expectations that we had set for them, which are basically win or be a failure, which it's impossible to live up to those kind of standards every single time. Like at some point you're going to fail if those are the qualifications, like the expectations that you need to have. So that is basically what happens with men's USA basketball is more so than this women's national team stuff that's happening, because if we lose in the finals, it would be embarrassing, right? If we got silver, we were runner-ups, people would be like, this is disgusting. It's a failure. It's embarrassing. Blow up the program. Blah, 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 blah. Like, it would be a nightmare. And a lot of times, it looks like we really do sleepwalk in basketball. And people start to think that now with this women's national team stuff, where we are so good that we should just win. They spoiled us the past two World Cups, winning back-to-back World Cups. It spoils you because now all of a sudden you're like, well, we're definitely the best. Like it's not even close. We're going to smoke everybody. And then to lose in the round of 16, now you're like, oh my God, we need a new regime, blah, 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 blah. And to be fair, a new regime is coming. There are a lot of players. I mean, Julie Ertz, just retired. She's only 31 and she retired from the U.S. women's national team. Megan Rapinoe, this was her last World Cup. And unfortunately for her, her PK just whiffed it wide up and to the right. So that must have been like a gut punch for her. Although there are a lot of weirdos on social media who were like, oh, like she won an ESPY and like she, you know, is this gladiator for women's rights and gay rights and stuff like that. And she missed, you know, she failed her country. Ha ha ha. People are literally like that online. It's mind blowing. And they were Americans are like relishing in the fact that someone else, like a fellow countryman, countrywoman, country person, failed on like a national stage, and people are laughing at that. They're like relishing in that fact. And it's insane to me to think that, you know, people are the haters are real, man. Like there are literally people who are like watching the women's national team to watch their downfall, to hope they lose so they can be like, haha. Doesn't make any sense to me, but yeah, there are a lot of those. And that's why social media is kind of like a waste bin of a toxic environment sometimes. But she's gone. Megan Rapinoe, she's going to retire. So those are off the top. I think there's a couple more people who are retiring from the women's national team, a couple players who are retiring. So we're going to have like a new, at least going into heading into the next World Cup, there will be a lot of new faces and a lot of younger players who are going to come up and fill a lot of these shoes that are being vacated for the women's national team. Who, again, these players, they're not like no-name players. They're players who were on those back-to-back World Cup teams, right? They've been there since their 20, 21, 22 years old. So it's just funny that, you know, the women's national team gets held like that. And then the men's national team, there's basically zero expectations for the men's national team, the men's soccer national team. Zero expectations. Like, if we make it out of the group stage, last summer, when we did make it out of the group stage, it was like, oh my God, like, what an accomplishment, blah, 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 blah. We tied England and was like, the memes that spawned from the USA tying England was so funny. So it's just the discrepancy in talent level and therefore the expectations is huge. But it is disappointing to see that. Yeah, you can be disappointed, like, because it's fair to have high expectations. That's a fair thing in sports. Like, expectations are expectations. That's how we gauge whether you're whether, you know, we tear you up or tear you down or build you up. Right. That's why expectations guide us. Is it fair? No, not really. But for the women's national team, it is fair to look at and be like, well, what happened? You know, what went wrong? That I'm all open for. You know, what went wrong? What did they do wrong? What could they improve on? How did this happen? You know, what areas of the game were we lacking in? And is that why we lost? From what I can tell, it's really offensively. We just suffered from a lack of elite striking, and that's why they lost. Just couldn't put goals on the board. So it's tough. And that's something that is obviously going to change now into the future, where there's, again, new people coming in and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be much different moving forward. But we did get a glimpse, not to the same level as USA men's basketball, of course, but we did get a glimpse as to, you know, these two programs for our country that represent our country are held to such a high standard that when they don't meet those unrealistic expectations, we basically tear them down and say it was a miserable failure and everyone should be ashamed of themselves. And it's not right, but it's just the way that sports go, unfortunately. The Hall of Fame enshrinement for the NFL class of 2023 was this past weekend. A lot of memorable faces for me, a lot of players that I grew up watching, and then a couple of older guys. So shout out to the older guys that got in to the Hall of Fame after the fact. Don Coryell, who's a coach from 73 to 86, Chuck Howley, who was a linebacker from 58 to 73, and Joe Klecko, who's a defensive lineman from 77 to 88. Klecko, out of those three older guys, Klecko's the only one who I actually like heard of his name before. No disrespect to the other two. I'm just too young to know those dudes. I'm sure they were great in their time, right? That's why they're in the Hall of Fame. As for the guys that I grew up watching that are now in the Hall of Fame, Rondé Barber, Joe Thomas, DeMarcus Ware, Zach Thomas, and Darrell Revis. So starting with Zach Thomas, linebacker for the Miami Dolphins. I think he played for the Dolphins for his entire career or close to it, or maybe he played for the Cowboys. Part of me wants to say he played for the Cowboys too, but I think he went in as a Dolphin. So shout out Zach Thomas, insane middle linebacker. He was like, I think a 6-time All-Pro. He was on the ballot for like a long time. He probably should have been in a year or two ago. So he waited quite a bit to get in. I think the two first ballot guys, Revis and Joe Thomas, were the two first ballot Hall of Famers. Joe Thomas, longtime Browns left tackle, maybe arguably the best left tackle of all time. Never missed any times, played like an insane amount of consecutive snaps in a row. And just one of the best offensive linemen of all time. And the older you get, the more you appreciate offensive linemen in the game of football. And Joe Thomas, like, it is a crime. Shout out to him for staying with the Browns his entire career. I don't know why he did that, but he decided to do it. So, like, salute. But he was just the definition of job security. Dude just did his job, didn't let his quarterbacks. It is crazy that he was so good at his job, and the Browns just could not find a quarterback for over a decade. Man, it is disappointing that he had to just sit. Like, you worry so much about, all right, let's get our quarterback, and then you have to worry about, oh my God, our offensive line, like, our quarterback's getting hit too much. He's getting sacked too much. He's getting knocked down. You know, we got to rebuild our offensive line. Joe Thomas was a generational tackle, but I'm just saying, if you just find a good left tackle, you're, you know, thanking your stars. The Giants just signed Andrew Thomas, and I'm so happy because he was so bad his rookie year, and over the past couple seasons now, has just made unbelievable strides. So he is, I think PFF graded him as the most, or they had them as like the highest graded left tackle in football, or offensive tackle in general in football last year. Or maybe it was offensive lineman. It might have even been broader than that. Not even tackles, linemen in general. So he is, I'm so happy we locked him down, and to have a left tackle is so important in this league. And Joe Thomas doing it at such a high level for such a long time for some terrible quarterbacks. Salute, dude. Like, respect for staying with Cleveland your entire career. DeMarcus Ware. DeMarcus Ware, dude, is like someone who gave me nightmares growing up. He was on the Cowboys for a majority of his career, went to the Broncos when he was still elite, and then towards the tail end of his career, won a Super Bowl with the Broncos when they beat the Panthers. When was that? Whatever that was, Super Bowl 51, I think it is, 52 maybe. But him and Von Miller, one of the deadliest line edge rusher duos in the history of football. And that's when DeMarcus Ware was like a bit older too, which is the crazy part. Like, he wasn't even in his prime when he was lining up across from Von Miller. And he was still able to make like an insane impact, because they won in 2015 and he was like 33 years old. And he played one more year with Denver and retired. So shout out to DeMarcus Ware. He hounded Eli Manning for a long time when he was on Dallas, and he scared the daylights out of me. He is one of those guys, I would say, honestly, like, if you're talking like edge rushers that I feared in the NFC East, because I watched so much of the Giants growing up. I mean, he's like probably top two in terms of dudes that were just, every time they were on the field, you were watching the Giants play the Cowboys, I was just deathly afraid of that he was just going to burn through and nail Eli. So DeMarcus Ware gets in. Rondae Barber gets into the Hall of Fame. A long, really successful career for him as a defensive back for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And honestly, I see Rondae Barber get in, and I'm just like, I feel like Tiki should be in also. Like, Rondae Barber, he won a Super Bowl. Of course, he's a 3-time All-Pro, won a Super Bowl with the Bucs, 5-time All-Pro. He played with Tampa Bay his entire career from the ages of 22 to 37 as a cornerback safety combo. Really, 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 really good defensive back. And a guy that you can just count on to go in, year out, and perform and play. He actually only missed a few games in his career. He played all 16 games. Every single game he played from 2000 to 2012. For 12 straight years, he played and started in all 16 games. In 1997, he only played in one game, didn't start a game. I don't know what was that was really about, but he was 22 years old. He was a rookie. In 1998, he played in 16 games, only started in 9. 1999, he played in 16 games, started in 15. And then in 2000, he was the full-time starting cornerback for the Bucs and played there. So just a totally reliable dude to go out there, guard your best receiver, and do it well. And certainly deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. I like that he's in the Hall of Fame. I just, obviously, him and Tiki are identical twins. So every time I see him, I just can't help but wonder, does Tiki Barber deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? Now, Tiki is such an interesting case for me because he was my favorite player growing up. I had like a real affinity for running backs. Growing up, it was my favorite position. I never played football when I was a kid. I was a baseball kid. But I always loved the running back position. I just thought they were like the most exciting players to watch on the field. You know, Tiki, Fred Taylor, Priest Holmes, LaDainian Tomlinson were just some of the guys that I really had like an affinity for growing up. And Tiki is such an interesting example because you look at the running back climate now, it's basically like hard cutoff at 27 years old. That it, you know, the rookie contract's 4 years or whatever. So 22, 23 years old, you get 4 years, you're 26, 27, you're coming off your rookie deal, you're looking for a new contract. It's happening right now with guys like Saquon and Josh Jacobs, right? And they're not getting paid because the mindset is for owners and GMs, don't pay running backs. And that's the landscape of the position right now. But with Tiki Barber, he's such an interesting case because his career would have been over. His career would have been over really early if this was like any indication of if he was playing in today's climate. Because look at this. He gets drafted in 1997 at the age of 22, right? He plays in 12 games, starts in half of them. 136 attempts, 511 yards, 3 touchdowns. The next year, 23 years old, I think at this point in time with the Giants, he's splitting time with Ron Dane, who was like sensational in college and just didn't really pan out in the NFL. But 1998, plays in 16 games, starts in 4, 52 attempts, 166 yards, no touchdowns, does nothing his second year. 1999, 16 games, starts in 1, 62 attempts, 258 yards, no touchdowns. Again, horrible. The year 2000, he breaks out. Finally, I think this is when he becomes the lead back for the Giants. He's 25 years old at this point in his going into his fourth year in the league. And it's not like he's super injured, right? Or he's just like he's not really getting attempts in general. So maybe, you know, the Giants are just not thinking he's this guy. He is. If this was today, he'd be flamed out. People were saying, oh, he's a bust. Move on, forget about him because he's not putting up any stats. He's not getting a lot of attempts. And everyone will just say, well, clearly the Giants don't think he's the guy. 2000, at the age of 25, he has a breakout. He starts in 12 of the 16 games that he plays in. 213 attempts, 1,006 yards on the ground, 8 touchdowns. Giants go to the Super Bowl. They lose to the Ravens, right, in 2000. Then at the age of 26, plays in 14 games, starts at 9. 166 attempts, 865 yards. So a little bit of a dip there. Now, his contract would be over, right? He's entering his age 27 season in 2002. Tiki goes on a run from 2002 to 2006 where he is a beast of a running back. A beast. This is from 2002 to 2006. 1,387 yards, 11 touchdowns. 1,216 yards, 2 touchdowns. 1,518 yards, 13 touchdowns. 1,860 yards at the age of 30 and 9 touchdowns. And then at the age of 31 in 2006, 1,662 yards and 5 touchdowns. Oh, and by the way, he didn't miss any games. He played in all 16 games from 2002. Every year from 2002 to 2006, for whatever reason, he didn't start one game in 2002 and he didn't start two games in 2004. He only started 15 and 14 games in those 2 years, but played in all 16 games, at least made an appearance and dominated. And then he retired at the age of 31 at the peak of his career, 4 consecutive seasons, only made 1 All-Pro team. And that was in 2005 at the age of 30 when he ran for 1,860 yards. But then he retired at the age of 31. Notoriously, of course, it comes out with the whole he questions Eli's leadership, doesn't think he's a good quarterback, yada, yada, yada. That leads to resentment from the Giants organization to Tiki, and he kind of alienated himself. And of course, the next year after he retires, the Giants beat the Patriots and win the Super Bowl. So it was kind of like a big middle finger to Tiki. And, you know, the Giants fans were like, see, Tiki was the problem, blah, 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 blah. So that part, I think, kind of smeared his career accomplishments because of how he exited the Giants. But he had a complete polar opposite career as to what running backs are having nowadays, where they perform high coming out of college and then the production falls off. And now it has evolved into this. We don't really like need to pay running backs anymore. Tiki. Now you can look at Tiki and say the reason why he was able to produce from the ages of 27 to 31 was because he barely played from the ages of 22 to 26. And to that, I'd say, you're probably right. There probably is a correlation to that, that he didn't get completely run into the ground as soon as he was drafted from the ages of 22 to 26. And then that's why from the ages of 27 to 31, he had, quote unquote, fresh legs to be able to actually produce at a high level for the New York Giants. But he was unreal. The stats are there. Like, I think if you look at those seasons, those brief seasons, he was really, really, really good. But because his career was so short and because he didn't have like multiple All-Pros, he just had that one year where he was an All-Pro. It's just not enough to get him into the Hall of Fame. But to say that he wasn't the best at what he did for at least 2+ years would be crazy. Like, he really was. And again, I'm a little bit biased because I really liked Tiki Barber growing up, even though he did, you know, try to smudge my quarterback's image and leadership abilities. But I love Tiki, man. And every time I see Rondé now, I'm like, that sucks. Like, I always thought Tiki Barber was the better player. And I think if you go into, I don't know, probably not, actually, because Rondé was a 3-time All-Pro in 2004, 2005, and 2001. Tiki was only a 1-time All-Pro. So I guess, you know, Rondé would be considered the better at his craft than Tiki was. But Tiki was a beast, man. So unfortunately, I don't think, that's why he's not in the Hall of Fame. I think just because of the brevity of his career. But he was one of the best, and he was super fun to watch, except for his fumbling problem. His fumbling problem was a real big issue. But he fixed that eventually. If he continued to play, I would love to have seen what he could do, because he was at the peak of his career when he retired. It's so interesting to look at his career, just because of the complete opposite of how running backs are treated nowadays. It's insane. And a lot of other guys, if you look at a lot of dudes in the late 90s, early 2000s, mid 2000s, it's the same way with a lot of those guys, where they're able to, you know, produce in their late 20s, early 30s before retiring. Like, we'll never see another Frank Gore again, honestly. It's pretty insane to think that way, but we won't. But I just went on a whole tangent about Tiki when Rondé's the one who got into the Hall of Fame. So shout out to Rondé Barber, and shout out to their mom, Mrs. Barber. I would imagine she's still married. Maybe she's not. I don't know. But she is the first one that I remember to be wearing that split jersey kind of thing. You know how the Kelce's mom did that when Travis and Jason Kelce played each other in the Super Bowl this past year. She was all over like ESPN SportsCenter talking about how her two sons are going to be playing in the Super Bowl together, blah, 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 blah. But Tiki and Rondé were the first. Their mom was the first one that I remember seeing who had the split Bucks Giants jersey down the middle. So pretty cool. And I think Rondé was 21 and Tiki was 21. Or Rondé was 20, number 20, and Tiki was 21. So just one number off. It's pretty cool. And finally, of course, the man of the class, I would say, Darrell Revis, I'm not going to say arguably the best corner of all time. He's not, but he's definitely top 5, I would say. I would say Darrelle Revis is the top five cornerback of all time. Revis Island put on some weight. Revis Island looks like they've been expanding their restaurant chains. Let's just say that. But he looks good. Like, he just, you could tell he put on some weight. And it's always funny seeing these athletes who are just in the top 0.001% of human physical peakness in their primes. And then when they retire, you know, they stop working out and they stop taking care of their bodies to the degree that they were. And they put on some weight, and all of a sudden everyone's like, oh my God, he's so fat. It's like, buddy, he'd still smoke you. I'll tell you that much. So Darrelle Revis, man, he was the man of the hour. He was the prime guy there. And of course the Hall of Fame game happened. And I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the Hall of Fame game, but the Hall of Fame game was the Jets and Browns. And for people who didn't know, which this was on Craig Carton's show on FS1, which I don't like, but sometimes, you know, daytime sports television is not really too good anymore. But I was watching it one day and Plaxico Burress informed him that they picked the teams to play in the Hall of Fame game based on if you have guys going into the Hall of Fame. They'll pick two of those teams and have them play. So the Jets and the Browns were the Hall of Fame game this year because Joe Thomas and Darrelle Revis were getting jackets, and they were the ones that were like honored in that game. That's why Goodell picks those two teams to play, which I'm not sure a lot of people knew, because to be honest, I didn't know either. It makes total sense, but like, I didn't really put two and two together as to like why they pick the teams that they pick to get to play in the Hall of Fame game. But it makes sense that it's because they are teams that are going in, or they have players for those teams that are going to the Hall of Fame. But Darrelle Revis, man, he was a freak. I don't think I appreciated him at the time, but to have someone like him is just, it's fun. It's got to be fun that you just to see, let's see if, you know, Andre Johnson can beat Revis this week. Let's see if Randy Moss can beat Revis this week. Let's see if, Ocho Cinco. Yeah, I think everyone, it was T.O., Randy Moss, Chad Johnson, Andre Johnson. Like, these are some of the guys that he would go up against frequently, and he would love it. And to welcome that challenge and to be like Revis Island, cheesy, sure, overplayed maybe, but true. Like, it is absolutely 100% true where he's over there and he's locking you up. Like, you're not getting any play, basically. You can try to throw the ball towards him, but the chances of him breaking up that pass are very high. So I have a profound respect for Revis and his craft and just being a sensational player that you can count on every week. It felt weird post Jets. You know, it just didn't feel right. Like, the fact that he was on the Patriots for like a year and then he was on the Chiefs for like a year, it just didn't feel right. Obviously he went in as a New York Jet, but it was weird. One of those things, you know, Montana in a Chiefs uniform, Brady won in Tampa Bay, but like, him in a Bucs uniform still feels wrong. You know, it doesn't feel like it belongs there. And there's a lot of guys where you can look at them and say, I don't really like this. Like Philip Rivers in a Colts uniform was very peculiar in that one year he did that, even though they did go to the playoffs. Like, things like that are odd, but fun, I guess. When you look at it, it's like, is this Photoshopped? Andre Johnson, who I just mentioned, right? He played for the Titans for a year. Randy Moss played for the Titans for a year. Even Randy Moss, even though it was earlier in his career, him in like an Oakland Raiders Oakland Raiders uniform felt weird too. So you just get things like that sometimes that are strange. But shout out to the Hall of Fame class of 2023. Last bit of football news: Alvin Kamara suspended for 3 games due to his incident during the Pro Bowl weekend last year, I think it was, right? Last, or maybe it was this past February, actually, right? When it was, I think it was this past Pro Bowl. So when they were in Vegas, I'm going to assume the pictures I saw were real. He beat the snot out of some dude, him and one other player, but he's the headliner, of course. And he pled guilty. It went down from, you know, felony assault to a misdemeanor. No jail time for him, but he is suspended the first three games by the NFL, which you had to have figured the NFL was going to hand down some type of suspension based on the legal repercussions for Alvin Kamara. He released a statement. I was completely wrong. I embarrassed the Saints. I embarrassed my family and my mother. I embarrassed myself, embarrassed the city and the Shield, obviously embarrassing the NFL. So he is remorseful, of course. And then also, who's the other guy? Colts cornerback Chris Lammons, was also involved in the same incident and was also suspended for three games. Again, Kamara is like the headliner there because he's a really good football player. But he is, you know, remorseful, and three games, not that bad. I hate to sound like this dude, but I want him in fantasy. I still want him in fantasy football. Draft him in like the fourth round, maybe, perhaps, possibly. But one other bit of Saints news, shout out to Cam Jordan. This is from Adam Schefter. This is his tweet. This marks the fourth multi-year contract between Cam Jordan and the Saints, and it will take Cam Jordan through his 15th season with the franchise. He has played in 16 games in every single season of his illustrious 12-year career. His 115 and a half career sacks are second most among active players, behind only Von Miller, who has 123 and a half. Cam Jordan also now has played in 192 games in a Saints uniform, which is he's on pace to surpass Ricky Jackson, who had 195. And Morton Anderson, who played in 196, for the second most games played as a Saint, with only Drew Brees, who played in 228, ahead of him. This is a nice little tidbit at the end. His next stop after New Orleans is expected to be Canton. So shout out to Cam Jordan. Fourth multi-year contract with the same franchise. Like, that's awesome, dude. It is so cool that he's just been a staple for that team for such a long time. And it has been exceptional. And I feel like is probably one of the most underrated defensive linemen in the entire league, because I feel like he just doesn't get talked about enough. And every single year, he is really, really, really good. To wrap up our football news, notable first-time eligible players in the 2024 Hall of Fame class: Eric Berry, Jamal Charles, Antonio Gates, Brandon Marshall, Haloti Ngata, and Julius Peppers. Gates, Ngata, and Julius Peppers are going to get in. Eric Berry, unfortunately, for as good as he was, his career was cut short. He had that battle with, I think he had leukemia, or maybe it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, one of the two. But he had cancer, and that took him out for like a couple years, basically. He was so, so, so good, and one of my favorite players. But I don't, you know, the longevity thing. Jamal Charles, maybe. He also suffered from some injuries, some brutal injuries that took him out for a few seasons. Brandon Marshall doesn't have the stats. Haloti Ngata, Julius Peppers, and Antonio Gates, I think, are the locks for the newcomers of the 2024 Pro Football Hall of Fame. All right, moving on to the hardwood, the NBA news that we have. It's a big one, big, but a lot of money. Anthony Davis reached a three-year, $186 million extension with the Los Angeles Lakers. Average, it's a back-ended more so. So towards the end of that extension, he's going to be making, I think I saw like $67 million for 1 year. An insane contract extension that he got. It kicks in, I think, not after this season, after next season, I believe it kicks in. So a massive contract for Anthony Davis. He's going to be in a Laker uniform till he retires, I would imagine. And they're still confident, like, Jeannie Buss and Rob Pelinka, they are still confident that Anthony Davis can be the guy to lead the Lakers moving forward after LeBron James retires and decides to hang it up. They're going to rely on him for that transitionary period and to reload and be competitive with him as the number one guy. And even more so going into this year, like, they're paying him to be the number one guy. They're not paying LeBron to be the number one guy. LeBron doesn't want to be the number, well, I want you to say want, doesn't want to be the number one guy. He's turning like 40 in December. So his body just can't sustain being the number one guy anymore. Regardless of still like how good he is and how high the expectations are for him and how everyone still expects LeBron James to be the best player on the court. And a lot of times he is. It's just hard for him to sustain that over, you know, 82 games regular season and then a deep playoff run. So Anthony Davis has to be the guy. And now they're paying him. They're paying him for, I guess, winning a championship 3 years ago, because they're not paying, they shouldn't be paying him for what he's been doing recently, because it hasn't been good. The playoffs, man, he there's so many times in the playoffs where it was like, this is the dude who you need to have every night. And then sometimes he'd just disappear and everyone would be like, what is going on? You know, like James Harden type stuff, where Harden, he had two like 50 bombs or close to it in the playoffs. And then two games where he scored less than 10 points, or three games where he scored less than 10 points. It was frustrating to watch. And Anthony Davis, like, you need to be that guy. You need to stay healthy. I don't know if it's his training regimen. I don't know if it's just his body. I don't know if it's just dumb, blind, bad luck. But he needs to stay healthy. Otherwise, you're going to be paying street clothes $60-plus million for multiple years. And that's not what you want if you're the Lakers, obviously. But the big money is being dealt out. When that contract kicks in, when that extension kicks in for Anthony Davis, he will be, as of right now, the highest paid player per annual salary in the NBA. Jaylen Brown still has the richest contract in terms of like guaranteed money, which is spread out over 5 years. This is 3 years, 186. Jaylen Brown, I think, was 5 years, 302-ish, 305, something like that. A little over $300 million. So AD, shorter contract, bigger, higher annual salary. I don't know how to feel about it. Again, like, there are definitely concerns and some red flags with Anthony Davis and with the Lakers giving him this kind of money where they are, but they have locked up their team for at least the next couple years. They've locked them up. They locked up AD. They got Austin Reeves back, D'Angelo Russell back, Rui Hachimura. You know, they are essentially trying to keep that same core that, to be honest, it came together really well in the playoffs. You know, that team post-trade deadline, because of injuries and stuff and people being nicked up, they didn't really play together for more than like 15 games. And then into the playoffs, they really started to vibe off each other. And that's why they were able to make the run that they did before running into the buzzsaw that was the Denver Nuggets. But even in those games, they were highly competitive games. You know, they weren't, the only game that was a blowout was the first three quarters of game one. And that ended in like, just, it was just a two possession game at the end. And the Lakers had a chance to win. They had a chance to win in every game against the Nuggets. So that roster is competitive. That roster that they put together at the trade deadline really, 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 really was well done. And I think it's the most, it complemented LeBron and Anthony Davis the best out of any roster outside of the 2020 championship team. That 2020 championship team was just like, obviously LeBron was younger and was able to shoulder the load offensively a lot more. But then Anthony Davis was great. KCP, Danny Green, Dwight Howard, JaVale McGee, like, those were pieces that really, really complemented Anthony Davis and a more close to his prime LeBron. Now, you have a couple playmakers. You have guys to be reliant on to make shots. I think D'Angelo Russell is better than what his playoff performance suggests. But yeah, I God, that's a lot. God, that's a lot of money for Anthony Davis. It's a lot of money. But what do you expect? And the salary cap's only going to go up. Like, oh, the players, good players are only going to start getting paid more and more. Like, the TV contracts are going to go up. Everything's going to go up for the NBA again. And people are going to step, like, within the next 5 years, there's going to be a player that makes $70 million in one NBA season. We're approaching that. We're approaching, like, we're... It's insane. Insane. But that's the way it's going, I guess. And there's really nothing you can do. Like, there's not... I have no alternatives. You have to pay Anthony Davis. It's just the way it goes. All right, so we'll wrap up the podcast this week with some MLB news. Tim Anderson and Jose Ramirez, man. That was the best fight of the weekend. It was crazy. I haven't seen that. That's Tim Anderson got put in an exclusive club this week. Like Robin Ventura, Jose Bautista, right? Like you're in that exclusive category where you got rocked. And it's unfortunate because Tim Anderson, what happened was Jose Ramirez slid headfirst into second base as Anderson straddled the bag. And I think Jose Ramirez took exception to how hard Anderson laid the tag down on him. I guess maybe he slapped him in the head or he slapped him in the back pretty hard. And Ramirez got up and was like, hey, man, like, what the hell was that? Like, why did you like tag me so hard? That was kind of weird. And they started chirping at each other. The umpire tried to break it up. And Tim Anderson and Ramirez like swatted his hands away. We're like, nah. And Anderson threw his glove down and put his fists up. Like he was ready to, he was squaring up. And he was owning Ramirez. Like Jose Ramirez is a stout guy. Like he's got a lot of more mass to him than Anderson. But Tim Anderson's like 6'1". Like he's a big dude. And he was wailing on Jose Ramirez until Jose Ramirez hit him with one of these eyes closed. I'm like, trying to avoid getting hit, but also just trying to land a punch at the same time. And he connected to the side of Tim Anderson's head and knocked him on his ass. And then the fight was essentially over and they broke it up. And Tim Anderson was being carried off the field and kind of wobbly. Like he was still chirping at Ramirez, but his legs were not like under him at all. And of course, because Tim Anderson's the one who's, he's the one who dropped the gloves. He's the one who squared up. And, he's the one who really started throwing punches. Like they got after it quick. And for him to be knocked down, then have to be carried off the field. People were obviously clowning him on Twitter and he's irate. Like he was, I don't know if, let's see if the tweets are deleted still. If he deleted the tweets yet, but with Jose Ramirez, he said he has had Tim Anderson has had a track record of doing stuff like that. But this was before, this was 17 hours ago. So this was last night at around 7 o'clock, you know, all this happening for a reason. We stay focused with this shit. We've been going through this shit for a minute, keeping track on me while I'm down. A lot of MF been switching up too. Hashtag fake shit. Yo got me fucked up for real, for real. Hope you picking up what I'm putting down too, the bigger picture. And then that was it. That was a series of tweets. That wasn't just one tweet. So I don't know what he's talking about. He changed his profile picture to King Von for a minute, but now it's just a black nothing. There's nothing there. For people who are watching, see, there's nothing there. So I don't know what's going on with Tim Anderson, but his ego's obviously hurt. He got hit pretty hard. I want to pull up this quote that Jose Ramirez said about Tim Anderson. Oh, I see. Okay, so I'm watching the video now. I'll try and find this quote, but I'm watching this video now, and Tim Anderson got the ball and stuck his glove out. Instead of tagging him, like, downwards, he stuck his glove out like he was almost trying to hit Ramirez in the face with his glove, like, straight out, instead of coming down with a tag like a normal person. And Ramirez turned around and was like, what the hell was that? And then the umpire tries to break him up because they're getting each other's face. They push the umpire away. Anderson drops his glove and throws his hands up. And then they start fighting. But it was really, it was brutal. Like it was a real fist fight. So this was Jose Ramirez's quote on the fight with Tim Anderson. I think he's been disrespecting the game for a while now. It's not just today. I've been having the chance to tell him during the game. As the play happened, he tagged me really hard, and then he wanted to fight, so I defended myself. And yeah, you can see on that. I know it might be taken out of context. People are like, "Oh, he just tagged him really hard. Baseball's so soft." But when you tag someone as a middle infielder, you get the ball and you go down. It's supposed to be a quick tag. It could be on top of the helmet. It could be on the back. Be on the hand. Whatever it is, try and get that tag down quick. Tim Anderson was straddling the bag. He gets the ball on the hop and he receives the ball, and then he holds it out. You know, he puts his hands out, he gets the ball, and he just juts his hands out straight into the helmet of Jose Ramirez as he was sliding headfirst between Anderson's legs into second base. That's why he got mad, and that's why they started chirping at each other. And I guess Tim Anderson chirps a lot, which doesn't surprise me that much, but he chirps, and, you know, he is outspoken. And we've seen him over the past several seasons when he was playing really nice. This year, he's been absolutely terrible. But when he was playing good baseball with the bat flips and the celebrations and like getting hyped up, and people love that. And I like it too. I like it for baseball. It's fine. But Tim Anderson, a lot of people, I guess, don't really like the cut of his jib, if you know what I'm saying. So Jose Ramirez being one of those dudes, and Jose Ramirez, perennially underrated dude in the MLB. Arguably the best third baseman in baseball for like the past 4 or 5 seasons. And he's on Cleveland, so that's why he gets overlooked a lot. But also a very quiet dude. Doesn't really talk, doesn't really showboat, doesn't do a whole lot of bat flips, plays hard, good baseball. And I guess he's one of those guys where it's like, if you're chirping at me and now you're like making a mistake. Like it's not really supposed to be like that. And he took exception to Tim Anderson's hard tag, which I don't blame him. And then, of course, Tim Anderson's the one who you could see Tim Anderson's ready to go. Like he drops his gloves and throws his hands up, ready to fight. Because Jose Ramirez, you know, in baseball, when bench is clear and there's a quote unquote brawl, a lot of it is pushing and shoving and grabbing of the jerseys. And the most you'll get is like maybe like a grappling match. But not too many punches are actually thrown nowadays in baseball. This was like a full-on, I'm going to mess you up mentality for Tim Anderson and for Jose Ramirez. And, you know, Anderson was swinging and he hit Ramirez a couple times, but Ramirez just came around the side with that right hook and hit Anderson right on the side of his head, which is like the temple of how that's, you get knocked out immediately as soon as that happened. And he got clocked. You could see Anderson fall down immediately. With just one of those wild hooks. As for other baseball news with the Yankees, my Yankees, post deadline's been a disaster, like just flat out an absolute disaster. Immediately following the lack of moves made by Brian Cashman and Hal Steinbrenner at the deadline, Domingo Herman checks himself voluntarily into a alcohol abuse program, rehab, because he has an alcohol problem. And there was an incident that took place last week, last Tuesday, I think it was, they said, where he showed up to the clubhouse, the Yankees clubhouse, blasted, just belligerent drunk, screaming at his teammates, screaming at other guys. There was a report that, you know, Cashman, Boone, and Garrett Cole were all kind of like shaken up by the situation. And then they put him in the team sauna to like sweat out the alcohol, which is not what you're supposed to do because alcohol and saunas are not smart. You pass out because of that kind of stuff. But it's pretty. Why? I hope that wasn't an accurate statement, but it is what it is. I just think that they handled that situation a little poorly. And, you know, is that the reason? I don't know if Tuesday was the day he got scratched from his start and then came in the fifth inning. But that happened also in the same week where Domingo Germán was scheduled to start. He didn't start, and everyone was like, well, why didn't he start? And Boone and came out and said, like, well, you know, we thought it was a little too close to game time because he wasn't feeling right. And then he was feeling okay. And it was a weird back and forth thing. And then he came in to pitch in like the fifth inning and threw really well. So everyone was like, well, if he came into the fifth and he just pitched really well, why didn't he start the game? Like, what's going on? And there was no real clear answers. This may have something to do with it. The fact that he has an alcohol addiction and a substance abuse issue. I wish him the best. It's nasty stuff. You know, I hope he gets a little bit. Yeah, I hope he gets better. I hope he gets the help that he deserves and he can come back and pitch. I don't think it'll be in a Yankee uniform. But I hope he does, you know, get his career back on track for his sake. But just absolutely insane. And then like not 2 days later, Anthony Rizzo is diagnosed with post-concussion syndrome. For those of you who don't know, it's that feeling of unbalancedness, blurred vision, lightheadedness, like problem with depth perception. Sidney Crosby suffered this a handful of years ago, about almost over 10 years ago now. I remember Sidney Crosby missed a lot of games because he had a couple concussions and then suffered from post-concussion syndrome. So it was, it's nasty stuff, dangerous things. Anthony Rizzo took a hip to the face from Fernando Tatis Jr. at the end of May. They're saying that's what it stemmed from. For 2 months, Anthony Rizzo has been the worst player in baseball. After being, he got off to a career hot start and then just was the worst player in baseball for 2 months. And everyone just didn't think anything of it because he passed his concussion protocol test and all that, which, okay, I believe that, but no further testing, no red flags being raised from Anthony Rizzo having historically bad numbers for not only his career, but just in baseball in general for 2 straight months. No reason to think about that. No reason at all. That's a red flag for the medical staff of the New York Yankees. Huge red flag. And on top of that, you add in the fact that everyone just gets injured all the time for the Yankees, right? Stanton, Judge, whoever, Donaldson, whoever it is. A lot of soft tissue stuff too. Not like broken bones or anything like that. So what is this medical staff doing right? Please tell me. Because I don't know what it is. And the Yankees are just, they had Germán and they had Rizzo immediately following a lack of moves from the trade deadline. So now they're worse because of injuries. And it's just, they're going to be a dumpster. They're 58-54. And it pains me because this team gives you a little bit of hope after they just win they split a 4-game series with the Astros at home. And it's just like, it gives you a little bit of hope. It gives you a little bit of hope, but we're dead. There's no shot. I don't think the Yankees make the playoffs at this point. Let's see where they are in the wild card. They were 3.5 back. And now they're 4.5 games back of the wild card. So now they're cooked. I just don't think it's for them this year. Buster Olney came out and said, I made a video last week. It's on my Instagram from My Point of View Pod. it's like the curb music because I was talking about last week, like, I want the Yankees to finish in dead last. I don't want them to make the playoffs because I want some like real palpable change in the organization. And like, of course, as soon as I edited that video and posted it, like Buster Olney on the Michael Kay show, said that if the Yankees missed the playoffs, there probably wouldn't be any significant changes. You wouldn't see any significant changes. And I'm like, oh God, why? Like, why? Why does this happen? How can this happen? Why is it like this? What can we do? you know, really, really upsetting. But I don't know. It just, it is what it is, I guess, at this point. There's nothing you can do but pray. But Carlos Rodon stinks. Like, he missed a majority of the season with his injury, and he's come back and been bad, like historically bad. It's actually gotten so bad for the Yankees. Luis Severino, I haven't even touched on. He is legitimately the worst pitcher in baseball right now, and he said it himself. Amongst AL starters with at least 25 innings thrown, Luis Severino and Carlos Rodon are in the top four. Hogan Harris for Oakland has a 7.80 ERA. Kyle Muller from Oakland has a 7.79 ERA. Luis Severino has a 7.74, and Carlos Rodon has a 7.33 with at least 25 innings thrown. And to top it off, what happens? What happens? Riddle me this, Batman. What happens when a really bad pitcher is really bad? He goes on the IL. That's what happens. They have some type of injury where something's not right. Maybe that's why he's not pitching well. He exited the game against the Astros after, let's see, this is his stat line before he exited the game against the Astros. 2 2/3, 3 hits, 5 runs, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts, season ERA 7.33. Exited the game with hamstring tightness. So I'm sure that'll keep him out for the rest of the year. He's been dreadful. Dreadful. I don't know. Like, he's on pace to be maybe the worst pitching free agent signing the Yankees ever had. And they've had quite a few that didn't work out for them, right? Carl Pavano is one that he's in my head forever as just bad. Just a horrific, horrific pitcher for the Yankees that they signed. And it was like, he's going to be great for us. And he was just not. He was just bad. So really, really, the frustrating season continues. At least it's not as bad as the Mets, I guess. But it's horrible. It's really horrible. And I was just talking about pitchers there, but I'm just like, Rodon might be one of the worst free agent signings ever for the Yankees. Like, Carl Pavano is probably one of the worst. Jacoby Ellsbury, I would say Pavano and Ellsbury are the two worst, like, contracts the Yankees have given out in the past 25 years. Easily. Like, not even close. And Rodon, in just, like, basically a month of being healthy in pinstripes, is rapidly approaching that list. Because this season, he's certainly not going to turn it around. So we're going to chalk this up as a unlucky break in year one, and heading into year two, ideally he figures it out and is the pitcher that he was for San Francisco and for the White Sox the past handful of years, because that's the pitcher the Yankees need. That's the left-handed pitcher that the Yankees need. And now Luis Severino too, like, oh my God, Severino, he's gone. He's done. Herman and Severino, they're no longer in Yankees uniforms, and Severino has a place in my heart. Yeah, he does have a soft spot in my heart, because he was the guy. Like, he was next up. He was the next great Yankees ace at just 21, 22 years old. Dominant, really just high hopes for him throughout the entire organization. You could see it. You could see he had the stuff. There was just like maybe one or two tweaks of consistency that he had to make. And then two major injuries back to back, doesn't play in the 2020 season, the shortened season. He gets injured in 2019, misses most of it, doesn't play in 2020, gets injured again and misses most of 2021, comes back in 2022 and actually pitches really well. And now this 2023 just has everything completely fallen off the rails. And I think now at 29 years old, when he was supposed to be the next best Yankees ace, is nothing but a liability. I think it's actually malpractice that the Yankees keep trotting Luis Severino out there every fifth day to pitch, because I don't even think Luis Severino wants to go out there to pitch every fifth day. He himself has said, I feel like I am the worst starting pitcher in baseball right now. Now, conversely, he's also said, I'm a starting pitcher, so I'm going to go out there and try and do my job every time I, you know, I'm sent out there. But like, the confidence for this dude is, not only is the stuff not there, I don't know if it's mechanics, I don't know if it's just his stuff's flat and it's his arm and he just can't throw well anymore. But regardless of any of that, his stuff is just, I mean, his confidence is just not there. He has, it's non-existent. Like, he goes out there and is just like, I wonder how many runs I'm going to give up today. That's what we're looking at with Luis Severino. So to keep trotting him out there and just expecting something different when it's been the same throughout the entire year is bad. And Rodon's the same way, except Rodon now is like, oh, my hamstring's tight. Get me out of this game. And now he's going to be on the IL probably for the rest of the year. I would be shocked if Carlos Rodon came back to pitch this year. Because, you know, hamstrings, they can vary. You can go back and forth. They can be like, you know, several weeks long, or they can be like a week long. But with Rodon, with how bad he's pitching, he's not going to pitch for a few weeks, and then he's going to slowly like rehab his tight hamstring. I would be surprised, shocked if he came back. All right, I think that'll do it for this episode of From My Point of View. At some point this week, I need to make the effort to get to the theater and see the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. That looks awesome. It has like that same animation style as Across the Spider-Verse and Puss in Boots, both of which were fantastic animated films that I thoroughly enjoyed. And the big draw for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is that they got actual like teenagers to play the voices. And they're, from some of the clips in the trailers that I've seen, their banter and rapport really, really is like an authentic four teenage brothers experience, which is really, really cool. And I'm very excited to get it. Ice Cube, Seth Rogen, all the other voice actors that are attached to it. Really dope. I'm really excited. Seth Rogen's been on a tear in terms of being a producer of late. He has really been killing it. So I'm very excited to go see this movie. Maybe I'll go tonight. It's Monday night. So maybe I'll go tonight. But that'll do it for this episode from my point of view. Thank you all very much for listening. I appreciate you as always. Have a great rest of your week, and I'll talk to you all next Tuesday. I know.